thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 89, Strategic Humanism at UVA. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Campus, episode 89, the last episode before our summer hiatus. And in fact, I think I'm even justified in saying that this is an extra, extra listen all about it episode of Digital Campus, because we might have gone on hiatus earlier if we had, A, thought about it, and B, if we hadn't encountered a really big breaking news story. I'm talking, of course, about the goings-on at the University of Virginia. We'll get more into that story later, but first let me tell you all about who's here. I'm Amanda French of AmandaFrench.net. Mills Kelly of Edwired.org is not with us today, but we do have Tom Scheinfeld from FoundHistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi. We have Dan
Hello.
Cohen from DanCohen.org.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. And we have a special guest, Bethany Novisky of Novisky.org, which is N-O-W-V-I-S-K-I-E. Bethany Novisky is president of the Association for Computers and the Humanities this year. But in addition, she's also director of digital research and scholarship at the University of Virginia Libraries. Hi, Bethany.
Hey, Amanda.
And full disclosure, Bethany and I have known each other for many, many years. We used to work together on the Rosetti Archive, which is where I learned to use the command line. grep. I have fond memories of learning to grep on the Rosetti Archive. I think Bethany was, I don't think you were exactly my boss, Bethany, but you were certainly had a much more responsible and higher up position than I had at the Rosetti Archive. So
yeah, I think that was right around the time that I was becoming design editor at the archive.
Yeah. So we are part of a cohort that has since created a digital humanities diaspora around the nation and indeed around the world. But we're particularly happy to have Bethany with us today because, of course, one of the main stories we're going to talk about is what's been going on at the University of Virginia. Now, I'm going to give as short a summary of what's been going on as I can. I think probably most of our listeners do know what's going on already, but just for sort of archival purposes for future listeners. So, and I've gotten a great deal of this this summary from the great timeline at the Chronicle of Higher Education. But basically, there's almost nowhere you can go on the internet that's any kind of a news outlet that isn't covering this, it feels like to me. But we'll put links to at least that Chronicle coverage in the show notes. But here's a summary of what's happened so far. So Sunday, June 10th, the rector of the Board of Visitors at the University of Virginia announced President Sullivan's resignation. Right around that same day, Peter Kiernan, who was chair of the Board of Trustees at the Darden Professional School of Business, the Graduate School of Business, accidentally hit reply all on an email suggesting that he was involved in asking for President Sullivan's resignation. And actually, I should begin by saying Teresa Sullivan had been president for about 2 years. She had replaced John Casteen, whom I remember very well, as president of the University of Virginia, who had been president for about 25 years, I think, or at least 20.
20, yeah.
I actually really liked him as a president, too, when I was there, and he had come from the English department. But nevertheless, June 14th, partly because of that leaked email, Peter Kiernan resigned from the Board of Trustees at Darden. And during that whole week, This is actually, I think of this as the week before that camp, speculation about why the board had asked for President Sullivan's resignation was just sort of simmering. We recorded an episode of Digital Campus at that camp, and we had tried, you know, discussed whether or not to talk about this story. And at that point, on June 15th, there sort of really wasn't much known. There was this sense that it was a really sudden resignation, and we didn't really know what was going on, but we just didn't have enough information. And so we decided not to talk about the story because we weren't exactly sure what was going on. So June 17th, which was during that camp, the Faculty Senate at the University of Virginia voted no confidence in the board. Clearly, a lot of things, you know, had been being discussed at UVA. The outside world was a little bit less aware of the story. But June 18th was when I remember getting really, really, really obsessed with it. This is right after that camp, you know, which was the 15th, 16th, 17th. So the 18th was a Monday. And that was when President Sullivan released her statement, which was a really articulate, without being defensive, it was a defense of what she had been trying to do at the university. I thought it was really well written and amazing. But so once she released that statement, it began to be, particularly to me, and I think to a lot of other people, really kind of amazing that the board had asked for her resignation. So June 18th and 19th, the board met for hours and hours into the wee hours of the morning, and eventually they appointed Carl Zeithammel, interim president. Carl Zeithammel was the dean of the Undergraduate School of Business. June 19th, during the day, Vice Rector Kington of the Board of Visitors of UVA resigned. There was some sense that he had been involved in what's called the ouster of President Sullivan. So he resigned because of the increasing criticism about this forced resignation. Bill Wolf, an extremely prominent faculty member in computer science, resigned with a very strongly worded letter saying, among other things, that he did not want to be involved in this fiasco at UVA. June 20th, the Cavalier Daily, amazing student newspaper, received emails, particularly from Helen Dragas, the rector of the Board of Visitors, and Kington and other people, some wealthy alumni. They had submitted this Freedom of Information Act request about a week ago, and a week before they actually got the emails, and so they put the emails up online right around June 20th. And those showed, among other things, that one of the apparent reasons for Sullivan's, for them to ask for Sullivan's resignation was her approach to online learning and specifically MOOCs, massive online open courses. June 21st, the next day, Helen Dragas, the rector of the Board of Visitors, who had been receiving the bulk of the criticism for this whole thing, released her 10-point statement about things that the University of Virginia was experiencing as problems. Again, without sort of naming names, it was apparently, her justification for what was, in effect, the dismissal of the president. June 22nd, Carl Zeithammel, who more or less stepped down as interim president. He said, look, until the status of President Sullivan as president is resolved, I don't really want to serve as interim president. During this whole time, it had been coming out that there was never really an actual meeting of the Board of Visitors to ask for the president's resignation. It seemed that Helen Dragas had been going around individually to board members asking for, how they would vote, whether they would vote with her. And then, told the president, we have enough votes to get rid of you, therefore we will accept your resignation, this sort of forced resignation type of thing. And that's, there's been a few things happening since then, mostly back and forth in the press. Certainly one of the things that's been happening since June 22nd is that the national press has picked it up in a big way. There's been an enormous amount of attention. One of the other major things that has happened is that the Board of Visitors has agreed to meet again this very day, Tuesday, June 26th. They're meeting, I believe, at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and there's a great deal of speculation about what's going to go on at that meeting. I should add, too, that the governor of Virginia sent a quite strongly worded letter to the Board of Visitors saying, you must resolve this situation at your meeting on Tuesday, or else I will dismiss all of you. Bethany, I want to turn this over to you now. So first of all, please correct or add anything that I've left out of that summary. But I also just want to hear from you, since you've been on the ground at UVA. I want to hear from you, you know, in your own words, what you've been doing at UVA since this whole thing first began and how you've been feeling.
Sure, sure. So first, the only things that I would add to your really good narrative would be, first, the sense of utter shock on the part of the faculty and upper administration of UVA at this move. It was a complete surprise. And I think we've all been really proud of the immediate presence of faculty, students, and staff, the convening of emergency meetings of the Faculty Senate and the General Faculty Council, groups like that, vigils on the lawn until 3 a.m. So, you know, we're really seeing an outpouring of love and respect for UVA. I think here on the ground, we were, of course, paying close attention to any statement that came from the rector or out of the BOV from the get-go. And so, you know, heard really early on that this claim that the fast pace of technological change, the explosion of free digital content on the web, the emergence of low-cost online learning, that all of these things posed an existential threat, the rector said, to the University of Virginia. So, you know, in other words, she launched this by framing democratizing technologies of access as a threat to the existence of an institution that is an institution of cultural memory, of research, of higher learning. So so the sort of disjoint there for us was really evident. But yeah, so you ask sort of what we're up to, how I'm feeling. I should insert the standard disclaimer that is, I'm speaking only for myself, not the institution, not my colleagues, not my staff. But I think it's fair to say that certainly I and a lot of us seem to be feeling hopeful. Like I said, there's this outpouring of love and energy, respect. For myself, I'm feeling pretty grateful. You know, I kind of want to say thanks, Rector Dragas, for giving us an opportunity to address head-on issues of faculty governance, to see the solidarity and the action of the Faculty Senate. You know, in many ways, this sort of like woke the Kraken. The slumbering faculty are slumbering no more. And it's not just been the tenured faculty at UVA. I am bowled over by the bravery and the energy of my colleagues on the General Faculty Council. I'm chair-elect of that group for next year. It represents 1,750 non-tenure track faculty and professionals like librarians who are on the general faculty of UVA, as well as senior research staff of the institution. So, so that group has been active and smart in its response. We're also seeing smart responses from staff bodies at UVA. And the Faculty Senate has now created task forces. This, I believe, is certainly the openness of the call to join these task forces is remarkable and new in my 20 years of experience at UVA. So lots of task forces to address specific issues that that have emerged through this whole lengthy now conversation. I've been asked to join the one on online learning, so we may have a chance to talk about the sort of relationship of online learning and the conversation about MOOCs and so forth. But I also, you know, more personally want to thank the rector. I gave a plenary talk sort of halfway through this mess at a Rare Books conference. This is not usually the kind of venue where the plenary talks make O'Reilly radar and the front page of Hacker News. But this one did. And, you know, the more people reading and thinking about the role of libraries and the digital humanities in these larger institutional and economic questions, and questions about the sort of overall mission and direction of our institutions of higher ed, I think that's patently a good thing. And she also solved a little problem for me. which is that the Scholars Lab, the department that I direct here at the University of Virginia Library, which is the sort of combination of the library's old electronic text center, geospatial and statistical data center, and a research computing support group out of our central IT division, plus an R&D unit. The Scholars Lab has been better known, I think, outside UVA than inside, you know, beyond our sort of digital humanities community. It's been, you know, unclear to me how much the other schools of the university, the education school, the business school, and so forth, were aware of what we're doing. And so, in turn, it's like it's annual report drafting and sort of goal setting time season at the University of Virginia right now. And so, one of my major ones for the coming year was going to be internal outreach. And so that seems to be a problem that is solved. but it's been an opportunity for some serious external advocacy to emerge too. You know, it's been great to hear my colleagues, Siva Vaidyanathan and David Germano, outline the resources, the initiatives, the sort of spirit behind UVA's digital work yesterday in the Chronicle. There was a piece in the Chronicle Innovations blog called The Right Way to Lead Higher Education Through the Digital Age that I think has a lot to make us here feel proud. So, yeah, the one thing that I am probably at this point taking away from the conversation about technology in UVA is there's been a local sort of joke around here for a long time about the not built here mentality that Virginia has about products, you know, new tools and systems and so forth. We have an extreme bias here toward open source and toward home built technology and systems. So when we want an institutional repository, we enter into a long-term, well-resourced and thoughtful project to help to build Fedora, right? When we want a library catalog, these things are usually purchased from vendors. Instead, we built our own, Blacklight, which was a Scholars Lab project that became key to the International Hydra Initiative. When we want to do like course management software, we don't buy it off the shelf. We use Sakai so that we can own it and we can mod it.
Actually, I remember when I was in graduate school at UVA doing a lot of support for the instructional toolkit.
Yeah, right. That was the precursor to that. That was another
entirely built in-house.
Yeah, exactly. And even for inherently multi-institutional initiatives, like there's a new one coming online that has really been that UVA has really been a leader in, called DPN, DPN, which is the Digital Preservation Network. This is meant to be a long-term, large-scale sort of systemic digital preservation project, a multi-institutional thing. That, too, has not been sort of top-down, like we all need to agree on the one platform. Instead, we've been fostering redundant local systems, kind of a grassroots, like a locavore approach to technology. And so, you know, there are downsides to that not built here stuff, but I am newly seeing all the upsides. It lets us be like balanced, considered. It lets us think about what's best for us, not what's the least common denominator, or not chasing what the so-called elite institutions, which were another thing referenced in the BOV's initial messages, not chasing what they're doing. It really, that kind of spirit of, you know, all hands on deck, we're going to build this together, kind of approach to learning technology and to digital humanities at UVA means that all sectors of our community, our local community, get a chance to shape the design of these things. And so I think that that's possibly at the, you know, it's one of the many things at the root of this community's response to what has happened over the past couple of weeks, that it's not the way we do things at UVA.
In the sense that they were, that the leadership was basically saying, oh my gosh, Harvard and MIT and Stanford are doing MOOCs. We need to do what they're doing.
Well, also just the top-down sort of unexpected. You've probably seen in the media a lot of talk about strategic dynamism, which was a sort of buzzword that I hadn't heard before. It's kind of formalized panic. That's not been the way that that we approach technology at Virginia. You know, we're an academic institution. We value consensus. We value well-researched approaches. We value things that reach out to all sectors of the community. So that's kind of it's just making me aware of how embedded into the technological ethos of UVA that those core academic values are.
Bethany, from outside the university, you know, you talked about what you were surprised about with the situation. And I think from outside the university, what I think all of us have been surprised about is what seems to be the Board of Visitors' apparent ignorance of all the things that you just mentioned. I mean, the creativity, the rigor, the thoughtfulness of work in digital media and technology at UVA, and really the sort of pioneering aspect to it.
I've been struck, Dan, very much by the same thing, and also the extent to which UVA has been a model for those elite universities that the Board of Visitors points to. I'm sure Bethany, you've been in the position of getting phone calls from people at Stanford, at MIT, at Harvard, asking you how it is you built the things you've built at Scholars Lab and its precursors.
Absolutely. So I promised myself I would not join into the pile-on on the BOV, but that was a surprise and a disappointment to us too. I mean, they have a very broad mandate. They're being asked to understand and, you know, grasp in a short amount of time a lot of things happening at the university. But I think a lot of us here feel that before they would, you know, they should, before making a decision of that kind of moment, should call on the local experts and see what's available and what is happening here.
I will say that we all know all too well that UVA is a dominant leader in the digital humanities and in other forms of, you know, just things related to the digital. I was actually Facebooking with my old roommate at UVA, and who was an anthropologist, and he was saying, you know, I never quite realized how far ahead of everyone else UVA was until I left there, you know, and you realize how far behind other universities are. UVA has always been so good at not only fostering digital forms of research in the humanities, but also bringing technology into the classroom. I mean, I had lots of positions that were kind of specifically about teaching teachers to use technology, and lots of stuff to do with new forms of pedagogy making use of digital tools. However, I do think that that's a very, very different thing from moving into MOOCs and online learning. Using technology in research and teaching is not at all the same as getting rid of the classroom and moving everything online. So I do wonder whether, you know, the powers that be just decided that all of that expertise wasn't at all useful because that wasn't the thing that they wanted to do. Like, I can, you know, UVA is a leader not only in digital research but in bringing technology into the classroom, but it sounded like what they wanted to do was just get rid of that notion of the classroom altogether.
Yeah, we heard a good bit about philosophical differences without getting a lot of clarity on exactly what the root of those differences were. But based on the work that President Sullivan has been doing here over the past couple of years, and on the sort of, I think you're right to see that. That the Virginia approach to technology has been to blend research with teaching, to see how they both feed into each other, and to think about, I mean, we've focused a lot since her coming on the undergraduate experience at UVA, and to think about how that plays into to undergraduate teaching and learning. Yeah, I mean, I can see that being profound, the sort of the value of that kind of approach versus sort of commodified, large-scale and anonymous MOOC-based approach. I can see that being a serious philosophical difference.
Seems like there's sort of two tensions here when MOOCs are raised in this kind of a situation. One is the, I think what a lot of people have seen of the sciences versus the humanities, right? That most of what these MOOCs have done, and I still think we need to go back to this like long history of MOOCs, because I think there's a longer history than people like the board know about, right?
Well, like correspondence courses.
Exactly, right. I mean, Open University and
right.
I mean, and even just online, right? I mean, the fact that they don't know anything about, say, Fathom.com,
right.
You know, to be literate in the knowledge of what's gone on online in the past 20 years. But you know, I think most of what we're seeing now is, you know, science versus the humanities, and the fact that these CS 101 courses are really big at Coursera and Udacity. we promised we would stop saying that, but I can't. It's so much fun. Udacity. Sorry, Sebastian Thrun. And then the other one, which I think has really come to the fore here at UVA, is vocational versus intellectual knowledge. And you know, again, I felt that there's just been so little discussion about that, and I think this is a healthy debate that we're wading into about this, of, you know, what the university is there for, right? Are we there for vocational training? What's the point behind such random topics as classics and German, these sorts of things? And, you know, I think that's a really important and healthy debate to have. I mean, what's been problematic about the board is that they did it very secretly, and the releases that have come out, which are very PR speakish, don't really kind of delve into this. I mean, if they said, you know, hey, we think we should be more about vocational training because STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and medicine fields, are where economic growth comes from, and we think that universities should be about economic growth, well, like, let's have that discussion. But, you know, it's just been, it hasn't been transparent in that way. And so I think it's been very healthy for defenders of the university. And what's really odd about this is, of course, it also flips the conservative liberal axis, right? I mean, shouldn't it be conservatives who are out there defending the classics? I mean, it is just so bizarre.
Well, one of the things that's been interesting about this is this has not been a very partisan issue at all. I've seen like a couple of instances of people, you know, defending what you might call the conservative or right wing or business oriented type of view. But they, I have to say, even in the Wall Street Journal, people will always acknowledge, you know what, this process was way too secretive. You know, the fact that there was never, there literally until today's projected meeting, there never will have, you know, there never has been yet a meeting in which the Board of Visitors said, yes, we should ask for the president's resignation.
You know? Right, right.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, Dan, I think you're right to say that this is the perfect time for conversations about this, and that these are needed conversations. This too is a place where the university is already, you know, working in this direction, hosting and holding conversations like this. They're happening all over the place, lots of different schools and groups. And we have an education school here. We've got an engineering school that's thinking about how to do online learning for students and how to, you know, democratize and broaden the reach of the teaching and training that they do. Here in the library and at the Scholars Lab, we've got some programs that I think, you know, trouble that distinction between the vocational and the intellectual. So the Scholars Lab has its Praxis program, which is a new thing for us going into the second year with funding from the Mellon Foundation. It's kind of a program that means to address graduate methodological training and to see if we can give give our graduate students in the humanities hands-on work experience in the digital side of the humanities. And so, you know, knowing that our overall goal is to be equipping knowledge workers for the work that they're going to be asked to do in the coming decades, whether that's whether they are future faculty or they're moving into alternative academic careers. We've also got the work of the Scholarly Communication Institute here out of the library. One of the major projects that we're working on is hosting some meetings that we hope will lead toward concrete pilot projects that can be implemented maybe here at UVA, certainly also at other institutions around the question of graduate training. What is it good for? What are we training these people to go out and do? And that's work that we're doing in collaboration with CenterNet, which is the International Consortium of Digital Humanities Centers, and CHCI, which is the Consortium of Humanities Centers and Institutes. And it's work that is like it's both conversation driven. You know, we're pulling in great people with diverse perspectives to help sort of broaden and deepen the conversation, but it's also data driven. So we're conducting surveys of the alternative academic community to ask questions about the preparation that they got at the university for the jobs that they find themselves in. So anyway, just wanted to say that it's that, you know, in many ways, it's an important conversation to have. It's also, I think, kind of a false distinction. And that's been what, you know, that will be the difficult conversation to have, you know, in a nuanced way, in a way that this conversation deserves to move forward, is to think about the degree to which the vocational and the intellectual interpenetrate. Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, Tom and I could go on about, Tom probably is about to go on about, so maybe I'll hand it over to him. But, you know, we've had lots of people come through the Center for History and New Media who've gone on to, you know, work at tech companies and things like that. But it's their experience dealing with more complex forms of knowledge, like humanistic knowledge that, you know, allows them to do stuff beyond just, you know, monkey coding.
That's right.
Sorry, Tom, hit it.
No, I agree completely with both of you that, and I do think that the real problem in all of this has been the board's lack of communication and unwillingness to have these discussions, apparently. Is where they've shut down discussion as well, where that there's been, I think, an unhealthy amount of ridicule of the kind of business speak with which the board seems to be speaking. I mean, some of it is intentional obfuscation, but then again, these are people who live in a certain culture, work in a certain mm-hmm. culture. A lot of them come from the business world. They have their jargon. I've myself ridiculed this term strategic dynamism, and I'm now rethinking that. Thinking, you know, we certainly have our fair share of cultural jargon in the humanities.
We need a good example. Objet petit a, perhaps.
I mean, structural modalities of, you know, like we do all kinds of jargon. We're expert at it. And I think that rather than shutting down discussion by ridiculing a certain culture of discourse, if you want some jargon, what we should do is we should engage and learn that jargon so that we can have these productive communication, have this kind of productive communication with these people. I think it would do all well to kind of try to understand the perspective of someone coming out of a private equity background, and the kind of perspective that they bring bring and the kind of experience that they have and the kind of language that they speak. And to the extent with which we can have those conversations, I think they're going to be more productive.
Yeah, and I don't know how much it's getting. I don't think it's getting out into the Twitter sphere at all, but that is already happening here at Virginia too, from the beginning. And in part, I think it was a response to the shock and embarrassment of Peter Kiernan's message, that the Darden School has been a site of a lot of the conversations that have happened. The Faculty Senate emergency meeting that happened on a Sunday on Father's Day was held in the Darden, the big classroom in the Darden School of Business. The response and the sort of fellow feeling and goodwill that people have shown toward toward Carl Zeithammel, the dean of the undergrad business school, has been extraordinary. So I think these are conversations that that we're certainly going to be having, and you know, absolutely, faculty from all of those fields are involved in the Faculty Senate conversations. General faculty representatives are involved in GFC conversations. So I think that's going to happen here. The duty of UVA, no matter how all this goes down later today, is going to be to push these great conversations outward.
And I think we're really good at this as humanists. I mean, if they want to play on that field of business speak, we can play on that field. Mm-hmm. Like, we're good at language. We can do that, and we can argue our case in those terms if we have to, and we should be prepared to do that. And so I think that's great that those conversations are starting.
Yeah, but I think your point is even a little bit deeper than that, which is that that we need to understand those perspectives too.
Well, and actually, yes. if you take it out of the jargon realm, you know, strategic dynamism, I have made fun of the term too. And again, you know, I wouldn't like all of my terminology, particularly in my dissertation, to be, you know, closely examined. And there might be things there that could be held up to ridicule. But really, when you got down to it, it comes down to something along the lines of faster decision making. And I have to say that in administrative positions that I've held, I'm very, very aware of that tension between making decisions and getting things done quickly and efficiently. Mm-hmm. It always seems to be in tension with gathering information, gathering opinions, deliberating, researching, you know, mm-hmm. and all of administration is kind of about that. And it's about balancing that.
It is about balancing it, but it's also about recognizing what's different about an institution of higher learning from a business, right? Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I in the summary that I gave, I don't know if I've, you know, talked about all of the different sort of deep emotions that this whole situation involves, all the different, you know, principles at stake. As Dan mentioned, it's about intellectualism versus vocationalism. It's also about state funding of higher ed, you know, it's also about university governance. It's also about, management philosophies. It's about all kinds of things.
It's about Jeffersonian ideals.
If I could complicate this just a little bit further, I actually think it's not as easy as saying, well, you know, business is fast and maybe business should be fast and universities are slow. There's actually a pretty, it's probably a minority position at this point in the business world, but there's certainly a very strong critique among people who study management and business that the faster philosophy has been problematic for business, and that there is a very strong critique of short-termism among people who study business, that firms are looking too closely at the next quarter's results, the quarter after that's results, and not thinking strategically enough, not moving, not looking at the long game. And so I actually think, you know, it's even to say, well, we have our values and they have their values. I think there are people who value long-termism in the business world, and so I think we should recruit those people to our cause if we think that a slower approach is valid for the humanities or for the university at large. Well, there's a whole business literature that we can appeal to that can help us make that case. case. We shouldn't just say, well, you do it this way, we do it this way.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tom. You know, my issue, though, is between fast and slow, there's also like fact-based decision-making.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the great things about universities is we try to base things on facts, right, and truth. And what I find most problematic, and we were sort of kicking around MOOCs before the podcast started and via email and prep for this special edition of the podcast, and my concern about what's going on with MOOCs right now is that they're being graded on a curve, and I think that's problematic. If we're going to be truth and fact based, then we can't base, you know, the rapid change of a giant enterprise, whether it's a business or a big university, forgetting about fast or slow. Just if we're going to say, well, we should be scared of MOOCs, we should be looking at, you know, what the facts are about MOOCs. And I think right now everyone would agree that, you know, they're being graded on a curve. I think, in fact, the people behind the MOOCs would say they're being graded on a curve because they're brand new and we haven't done any assessment on how well they work. And are we okay that Udacity has a 97% attrition rate? Is that okay? I mean, yeah. We can have a kind of fact-based argument about this.
Dan, here's another reason we might thank the rector. I want to read you the charge of the Faculty Senate Task Force on Online Learning that is just coming together and then I'm going to join. So the charge is, we will delineate and define digital and online learning, comprehensively determine what is and has been done at UVA, find quantitative evidence of its efficacy, costs, and benefits, and make strategic recommendations for our approach to digital and online learning at UVA. Our task force will operate with absolute transparency and will be focused on information gathering to generate evidence-based strategies. In other words, more data and less opinion. So just to
bingo. I mean, that's true. That's it, right?
And everyone needs that, like exactly not just right. UVA.
Yeah, know? That's what I mean. Like, so we can all say thank you, Helen Dragas.
Yeah, and again, you know, when you're talking about, you know, posing this as a cultural clash between business and academia or business and humanities has also seemed to be a bit wrong to me. Very fun, mind you. It's very fun to make fun of the other side for being excessively corporate or what have you. But wrong in this case, because there are also, you know, cases to be made, you know, just in terms of innovation, right? If you want UVA to be, you know, an innovative university for the 21st century kind of thing, well, then why would you just copy what Harvard and Stanford are doing? You know, like maybe there's some other way to do online learning besides these MOOCs, you know, so. So I'm very glad to hear about the formation of that initiative, Bethany. Committee, task force?
What do you? Faculty Senate Task Force.
Faculty Senate Task Force. That'd be great. Well, there's lots more to be said about this story. Maybe everything we've said will be vitiated today by the Board of Visitors meeting at UVA. We will have to wait and see. There were some other stories that happened this week, but I think in true extra edition style, we will not delve into them. But we did get a little bit of feedback at that camp about what people want from Digital Campus. And one of the things they mentioned was a return of the old website picks that we used to do. So I think we've had a nice hiatus from picking new tools or websites that are useful for us. Mm-hmm. But as host this time, before we hit our summer hiatus, I'm going to require that we do this again. I will, however, go first. This actually could have been a news story, but I'm going to use it as my pick today. My website pick for this edition of Digital Campus is syllabusjournal.org. This is a new peer-reviewed journal for syllabi that has just launched. I've been browsing around it, and it actually, number one, I think it's just great that there is a place where you can get syllabi. The peer review of it doesn't strike me as maybe being all that useful, and I actually think that the journal itself will be more useful once it gets more syllabi in it, because it's syllabi in all disciplines, and I'm not sure exactly how useful that's going to be. if you were able to kind of browse through a lot of syllabi and take things out of them that you might want to use, I think that would be a little more useful. But nevertheless, I think it's an interesting website, and we might keep an eye on it. Dan, do you have a pick for this week?
I do. I want to recommend this service from ReadMill called ReadMill Lists, readmill.com, which is, you know, part of the crowded marketplace of nice reading apps that includes things like Instapaper, which I'm madly in love with, and I think recommended on our last podcast at that camp. ReadMill now is running a service where you can curate a set of online reading, like let's say a set of 10 blog posts about a particular topic, and it will create for you a really nice looking EPUB and online reading environment if you just want to read it in your browser for those posts. So it sort of creates a kind of ad hoc ebook from things you found online. And it looks nice. It's great. You can keep adding to those lists. And I think it's a kind of nice way to sort of bring together some things you found online and make it really legible, easily read on a bunch of different devices.
You know what else does that, Dan?
What's that?
Anthologize.
Yes, I know. I know, but you need to import into Anthologize, which is good. And I think we're using Anthologize for the Journal of Digital Humanities. I think for just quick and dirty, making a, you know, quick list of things, it's a great way to go.
Tom?
Thanks, Dan. I'm definitely going to take a look at that. Yes. So I'm in classic digital campus fashion. I'm going to do a little bit of log rolling for a CH&M project. I'd like to point people to this just launched something we've been working on for nearly a year, ConnecticutHistory.org. In my move to Connecticut, one of the things I've done is I've had the opportunity to work with the Connecticut Humanities Council to re-envision a long-standing project of theirs. They, many states, have been working for several years on a state encyclopedia, an online state encyclopedia, and it had some ups and downs over the past several years, and had some trouble getting off the ground, due in no small part to the rise of Wikipedia. This was a project that was envisioned before the rise of Wikipedia, and by the time it had gotten organized, Wikipedia had emerged on the scene, and in some ways had made the idea of an online encyclopedia obsolete. So the idea was to rethink what a state encyclopedia was in the post Wikipedia era. And what we've done is we've reimagined it in many ways as a newspaper. It is a site that publishes daily on all items of interest to people interested in Connecticut history, and then much like the New York Times topics pages do. It aggregates those stories.
We actually played a little bit with ConnecticutHistory.org at the center right after it launched, and I found out such interesting facts about Connecticut as the fact that they tested the first nylon parachute there, and the parachutist was a woman.
Oh, so interesting.
I had no idea.
Hey, Amanda, before we get to Bethany's pick, can I just make a little bit of an edit, because I confused my reading apps. So it's actually called Read List. ReadLists.com, so plural, ReadLists.com. And it's actually from the Readability folks, although you can integrate with ReadLists from ReadMill, which is another app. There's too many of these reading apps. I get them all confused. So ReadLists.com. We'll link to it from the show notes. Sorry about that.
Great. Bethany, anything to recommend?
Sure, yeah. So my pick was going to be DS106, the Open Online Digital Storytelling course at Mary Washington, which strikes me as a great example of a MOOC, although not terribly massive, done right. My husband, who is a K-12 educator, is one of the community participants in it this summer, and also my precocious 9-year-old son, who is a Minecraft fiend, has been playing along with them. But then I listened to last month's Digital Campus and heard that you guys spent a long time talking about this. So my pick is going to be sullivan.lib.virginia.edu.
That's what I was hoping you would say. Yay.
Just came online at about 6 o'clock last night. It's an Omeka-based digital archive being assembled right now of materials related to the events happening at UVA over the past couple of weeks. It's work of the University of Virginia Library. The Scholars Lab has helped to sort of set up the Omeka infrastructure for it to accept community contributions. The library sprang into action to collect physical ephemera from what's happening here, you know, placards and signs, but also we have a fantastic digital archivist, Gretchen Guggen, who is working to bring in Twitter feeds and all Very of cool. the kind of she's doing terrific work, and so we wanted to have a place where members of the community could share pictures, audio files, video that they're taking out on the lawn, you know, just everything. So items are getting approved one by one to appear publicly by our curators. So if you go there now, there's not a lot of stuff, but things have been pouring in. And
it's been online since 6 last night, Bethany. I can't believe you don't already have an extremely rich and textured collection.
A lot of stuff has come in. We're just, you know, we're sort of doing this on the fly and figuring out as we go too. So even if you're not, you know, if you're not a UVA local, if you're not as obsessed with what's happening at Virginia as all of us are at the moment, this is going to be a pretty interesting site to watch if you want to see how libraries respond to the need to archive events that are happening that include physical ephemera and digital materials.
Do you know, this has been one of my favorite parts of the UVA thing. I actually I read a little bit about archiving the Occupy Wall Street movement, and of course some people here at the center were working with that, but I had read a little bit about Howard Besser saying, you know, that they were treated with a little bit of suspicion by the protesters at Occupy Wall Street, like, why would you want our stuff, you know, what do you want them for, you're going to try to, you know, give evidence against us, sort of thing, and you can't blame them for that, but nevertheless they've managed to set up, I think, a pretty good archive, physical and digital, of the Occupy Wall Street protests. But this, from the beginning, you know, partly because it is such a sort of higher education and cultural memory event, you know, the archiving seems to have been baked into it from the beginning. And I think I retweeted one of the tweets about how things are being archived. And perhaps for that reason, I happened to notice in my Google Docs that Gretchen, the digital archivist you mentioned, had shared a Google Doc with me, a Google spreadsheet with me.
That's right.
Added some stuff to it. You know.
Yeah, that's great. A lot of people have contributed that way. So that's what I mean. Everybody around here just really jumped into action. Gretchen set that up as the quickest and easiest way for people to start sharing links. Mm-hmm. And now we have this Omeka site for people who've been taking pictures out on the lawn. And I see that already some of the talks that were given at Sunday's rally are in the archive, and of course all of the physical stuff. So yeah, it's been terrific, and all of that is going to get merged. And we're already talking in the Scholars Lab about how we can help people mine it and visualize it and so forth.
That's been great. You know, my father actually went to UVA undergrad as well. In fact, reportedly, I was conceived at the University of Virginia. he now teaches urban planning down at Georgia Tech, and he was in China when this whole thing started happening. So I emailed him and, you know, wished him Happy Father's Day and started telling him all about this, and we had a little bit of an email exchange. And I'm going to write him and see if we can contribute those emails to the digital archive.
Yeah, super.
Why not?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much, Bethany, for joining us today. I know things are crazy down where you are, and I'm sure that everyone's best wishes are with you and the entire University of Virginia community.
Well, thank you. We all appreciate that.
Yeah, good luck, Bethany.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bethany.
Thanks,
thank you, Tom,
guys.
Thank you, Dan. And thank you for listening to this edition of Digital Campus. We'll see you in the fall.
Thing we have to fear is fear itself.
please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you.